morning and welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichen. Glad you could join us. Well, another Minnesota Democrat has announced that he wants to represent Minnesota in the U.S. Senate. State Senator Steve Kelly of Hopkins has officially entered the race for the Senate seat that's now held by Republican Rod Grams. Senator Kelly joins five other DFLers who have already entered the race, including Michael Cerisi, David Littlehaug, and Steve Miles. And there are at least two other Democrats who say they may end up running. Senator Kelly is an attorney. He was first elected to the legislature in 1992. He served two terms in the Minnesota House before being elected to the state Senate in 1996. He serves on several committees in the Senate, but perhaps most notably, Senator Kelly is the co-chair of the Year 2000 Legislative Task Force. That's the committee that's reviewing Minnesota's preparations for Y2K. Today, as part of our continuing Meet the Candidates series here on Midday, Senator Kelly has come by our studios to talk about why he has decided to run and to take your questions. It's a great opportunity, really, to get to know a little bit more about Senator Kelly and where he stands on the issues. So give us a call here. Our Twin City area number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Our guest this hour, Senate candidate Steve Kelly. Senator Kelly, thanks for coming in today.
Morning, Gary. It's a pleasure to be here.
I suppose the first place we should start, given the looming Y2K issue, are we even going to have an election next year, or is the world going to come to an end here in a couple of months?
Well, as I've said when I've talked to you about this before, that we expect Minnesota and the nation to be pretty well prepared. There will be, I expect, pockets where things might go wrong that we'll be able to cope with. And there are some lingering concerns about some of our trading partners, other countries, but it is not a panic situation. The world is not coming to an end.
Now, I noticed Bill Salisbury in the St. Paul Pioneer Press today in the story on your announcement yesterday described you as the legislature's technology geek. How do you plead?
Well, I have spent a lot of time in the legislature. When I was first elected in 92, people said one important way to develop some influence at the legislature is to develop some expertise in a particular area. And I became involved in telecommunications and information technology policy. But the important thing for me, and perhaps where I might depart from the geek label, is I'm not necessarily so good at the machinery itself, but I have tried to pay attention to how we put the tools in the hands of people so that they can transform their lives and prosper in the 21st century. This is important all over the state. It's especially important in rural areas to make sure that we don't exacerbate a digital divide based on geography or on income, and make sure that every Minnesotan's got access to the kind of infrastructure and technology training that's going to help them do well in the 21st century.
Now, there is a crowded field of Democrats who want to be a U.S. senator. There's an incumbent Republican holding the seat right now. He's seeking re-election. To run for the Senate, you're going to have to raise a ton of money. There's all the hassles involved in running a statewide campaign. Why subject yourself to all of that?
The reason is that I'm excited about the opportunities for Minnesotans, and I think what we need is a U.S. senator who's going to work with Minnesota families so that they can take advantage of those opportunities that have become available. The economy is doing extremely well. We've got job openings everywhere. Unemployment rate in Minnesota is now 2.5%, and businesses are looking for skilled workers. So in many ways, what used to be called social issues are now business issues. We need to improve people's skills. That'll help our businesses expand, but it'll also help the people who move into those new higher paying jobs do better. I'm excited about those opportunities, and I do not think that Senator Grams has been paying attention to those opportunities and helping to build up Minnesotans. there's been too much support of efforts to cut spending on research, to cut spending on education, the kinds of things that will actually help Minnesota families do better.
There are many, many, many issues, of course, that a U.S. senator would have to deal with, and we'll be talking about a lot of those. But if you had to pick out one or two of your top priorities if you were elected senator, what would they be?
I think education and job training, improving people's skills so that we're constantly raising the value of what we produce in Minnesota and in the United States. I think that's extremely important. It'll help people do better. It'll help businesses do better. A second area I think is important is paying attention to the national debt and Social Security. We ought to be finding ways, given the prosperity we're enjoying today, that to pay down our debt and to address the problem of Social Security so that we are not leaving our kids a burden of debt and the burden of paying for the retirement of the baby boom generation. We need to be exploring ways to make Social Security more self-funding and pay attention to the kind of legacy that we're going to leave to our kids.
Why do you think you're the best qualified Democrat in the race?
Well,
never mind your disagreements, policy differences with Senator Graham's, but just in terms of the Democrats, why are you the best candidate?
I've demonstrated a record of accomplishment in the legislature solving problems that make a difference for people. And I've done it in a way that stays away from some of the liberal, moderate, conservative labeling that people try to do and figure out a way to work with people to take care of the real problems that families are facing. And I think that ability to work across the political spectrum and build a coalition that focuses on solving problems and addressing real needs families have is the kind of record that will be successful among Democrats and then among the general electorate.
In terms of labels, I know you just said you don't like labels, but boy, we thrive on them in the news media. Where would you, what label would you hang on yourself if you had to?
Well, I have a voting record that I'm proud of that is consistent with Democratic values about working families and supporting people when the market fails to address their needs. But I've also done it in a way that is open to new ideas about how to solve some of those problems and that engages the business community and others in partnerships to solve those problems. So pragmatist, I suppose, would be the first label I'd apply.
Republican Party chair said, "Oh, you're just another old-fashioned Democrat, tax and spend liberal Democrat."
Well, he doesn't know me well, and I expect he'd say that about any Democrat who'd got in the race, since that's the cliche that the Republican Party would like to apply to all of us. But I think the record is that I've worked with Republicans and with Democrats to address some problems. And on property tax reform, from time to time, I've had the support of folks that you might call Republicans. So.
State Senator Steve Kelly is our guest this hour. Senator Kelly has announced that he is a candidate for the DFL nomination for the U.S. Senate seat now held by Republican Rod Grams. Senator Kelly has come by our studios today to talk about his position on some of the big issues facing the U.S. Senate and this nation. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're calling from outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free. That number is 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Great opportunity to learn a little bit more about Senator Steve Kelly from Hopkins. One way to get a reading, Senator Kelly, on where candidates, how candidates think and so on, is to kind of get their impression of people who are well known. How would you rate President Clinton in terms of his policy positions? Let's forget about the personal stuff, the policy positions.
I won't try to address every policy position, but I do think that President Clinton has advocated some things that are important. Education, addressing the needs of our schools, particularly the capital needs of our schools. You go to, I was in Marshall a couple weeks ago and looked at a building where they were trying to put the technology into the school, and in an older building, and you had these bundles of wires running along the walls and trying to get schools upgraded so that our kids will be prepared for the 21st century is a real cost. And where if the nation could step in and help address some of those costs, I think the president's on the right track there. I think on things like the test ban treaty, he is absolutely right that we needed to pass that, and I think the kind of partisan shot that the Republicans fired at the president just because they appear to be mad at the president rather than thinking about the good of the country is another demonstration of one of the problems that we've got in the United States today.
How would you have voted on impeachment had you been in the Senate?
I don't think I would have supported impeachment. I don't have a lot of support for the president's activities leading up to that, but I did not think that it warranted impeachment.
Mm-hmm. Test ban treaty, you've already indicated that you would have cast your vote in favor of that treaty. There were people who said, though, argued that it was fatally flawed, that it simply did not protect U.S. interests sufficiently. Forget about the politics of it again, that just was a bad treaty.
I think there are two angles on United States interests with respect to this. One is that we have a unique role now as an international leader, as the only superpower. And I think our security will be diminished if countries like India and Pakistan move forward with more testing of their nuclear weapons. And if the United States can't set an example as a world leader about how to address this problem, then we can't expect good behavior from any other countries. The second problem I always had was that the United States' current leadership is as the technology and economic power in the world. And if some other country were thinking that they could take a bet that our nuclear weapons wouldn't work just because we hadn't tested them recently, that's not a bet I would take.
Mm-hmm. What do you see as, and it's always hard to generalize, of course, about this, but what is the U.S. role in the world? Should we be sending troops to all these various hot spots to serve as peacekeepers and the rest? Should we pull back a little bit? And where do you see us in terms of power projection across the world?
I think we're going to have to be very selective about the use of our own troops, but I do think that we ought to be much more supportive of international institutions than we've been. And I think the fact that we haven't been paying our United Nations dues, especially now that our country is doing well and we have the money to make those payments, I think we ought to be going forward with those obligations to the United Nations so that we can use alliances and not play a solitary role as a world leader, but bring along other people. I had a unique opportunity to be at a seminar in Austria last summer and meet with people from about 40 different countries who are all working in nonprofit organizations. And just in casual conversation, their view of the importance of the role of the United States as a world leader impressed on me the fact that we have obligations not only to our own citizens, but obligations to think about how our interests can advance the interests of people elsewhere in the world.
You often hear, though, that we're trying to dominate the world. How do you reach that balance?
Well, the concerns I hear or have seen in the papers recently have been cultural concerns, perhaps more than expressed leadership concerns. And it's true that perhaps that McDonald's and other American cultural icons are becoming a larger part of, in the rest of the world. But I do think that on policy issues, we can play a leadership role without coming in looking like a bully. that if we approach some of these issues with a sense of humility and responsibility, but still say we're going to play a leadership role, I think other countries will appreciate that.
State Senator Steve Kelly is with us. He is now a candidate for the U.S. Senate seat held by Republican Rod Grams. Senator Kelly is a Democrat, joining a already crowded field of candidates for that Senate seat. Senator Kelly has come by today as part of our Meet the Candidates series to talk about the issues. And again, if you'd like to join our conversation, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Roger, your question, please.
Yes, sir. I would like to ask you, Mr. Kelly, how you could vote in case another case similar to Kosovo came up. Would the leadership role of the president be guided by the Constitution or by the president's sense of moral obligation? He said we had a moral obligation to bomb Serbia for Kosovo, and in doing that, he broke the Constitution. Didn't get a declaration of war. He broke the NATO treaty, which for 50 years had been a defensive alliance and went on the aggression, and he broke the UN Charter. The Mr. Chairman even said this could cause World War III. If something like this came up again, what would you do?
I think that the president does have a responsibility to identify places where it is useful or important to use American military power. That responsibility does fall to the executive branch, and I think consultation with Congress is important. I am not committed to the notion that every use of force requires a declaration of war. I think we need to be flexible in our approach to that. But I do think that consultation and engagement with Congress is important. And I certainly looking at that situation as we learned more about the kinds of things that went on, I think there is a case for the president's argument that we had a moral obligation to play a leadership role there.
In terms of the nation's defense budget, are we spending about the right amount, too much, not enough? What's your reading on that?
Well, I do think we need to spend appropriately on readiness and on the kinds of munitions that were used in Kosovo. I do think we need to be cautious about some of the bigger ticket items and this notion that we can buy multiple kinds of planes for every conceivable role. I think we're going to have to pay attention to some of that, and there are problems with the political getting into it. I know that the Senate Majority Leader has been pushing for more money for a shipyard in Alabama because he's been wants to make sure that some jobs happen there, even though the Navy isn't sure it needs the ship quite when he thinks it needs to be there.
Mm-hmm. Tom, your question, please.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for having me on the show. I just have a question about the legalization of industrial hemp. I wonder how the senator feels on that, and if he is going to push for that for the benefit of our farmers, or if he's going to, cower down to the political system on that one and keep the most useful plants in the world illegal to grow and keep abusing our natural forests. I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
I've supported moving in the direction of letting farmers raise industrial hemp. I do think that it is a useful crop, and we're going to have to figure out a way to draw some distinctions here, despite the concerns that it'll be some confusion with the more potent forms of marijuana. I think it can be an important crop. I think farmers, though, have to be cautious here because hemp could become another commodity where growing it is not going to be the solution to our farm problems because we'll just be in competition with other countries growing industrial hemp, and we'll be back in the commodity fight again. I think what we need to do in the United States, one step with respect to agriculture, is to do more to enable farmers to grow unique crops or crops that have a greater value that are designed for specific uses, whether it's as local feed or for as feedstock for ethanol plants, things like that. to look at places where Minnesota farmers or the United States farmers have a competitive advantage over the rest of the world.
In terms of agriculture policy, there has been a simmering debate the last several months about the 1996 Freedom to Farm Bill. Does that need to be totally overhauled? Is it okay as it is? Throw it out, start over? What's your reading on that?
I think a drastic overhaul is certainly the right thing to do. We need to have a agricultural policy that supports family farmers, but at the same time, along with changes to that farm program, we need to look at ways to diversify the rural economy, to add more high-tech businesses to rural area. One of the ironies that is a factor of both state and federal policy is that we have put rural economic development in the agriculture department, and we need to change that orientation and make rural economic development the same as economic development in the metropolitan area. We ought to be focusing on how we develop high-tech jobs, high-value jobs throughout our rural areas so that farm families have new opportunities for supplementing their farm income, or if they decide that farming isn't the best for them, they can stay in a rural area and have sustainable rural communities because there are valuable jobs for them to work on.
You think the family farm should be preserved pretty much at all costs?
Obviously, there are some limits to any policy that you'd want to have, but I do think preserving the family farm is important, and I do think there are things that we could do where we could accomplish a couple goals at the same time. Maybe the subsidies should be focused more on sustainable farming along with family farming so that we target our approach that way, not just at family farms raising commodities in competition with people from all over the world, focusing more on niche crops or trying to do the kinds of things that small or family farms are best capable of doing.
State Senator Steve Kelly is our guest this hour. Senator Kelly represents Hopkins in the Minnesota State Legislature. He wants to move to the U.S. Senate. He's running for the seat now held by Republican Rod Grams. Senator Kelly announced his candidacy for the DFL nomination for that seat yesterday. He's come by today to take your questions, give us a better idea of where he stands on the issues. And again, if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to some more callers in a couple of minutes.
Programming on NPR is supported by Bloomberg.com. Money markets and more on the web at www.bloomberg.com.
Our guest this hour is State Senator Steve Kelly, who is an announced candidate for the DFL nomination for the U.S. Senate seat, now held by Republican Rod Grams. And again, if you have a question for Senator Kelly, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Now, before we get back to our callers, Senator Kelly, a couple of items being talked about in the Senate today. One having to do with school vouchers, where if kids are in a school that is clearly failing, they would be able to get some federal help to move on to a private school. Would you support such a plan?
I think the federal government does have a role to play in education, but I think we need to steer our policies through the states. There's a balance here between local control, state control, and the role the federal government plays. And I do think the federal government's got to be cautious about implementing specific policies like federal vouchers that would undercut the kinds of reforms or policy approaches that are being tried in states. I think we ought to leave the states and the local school boards in more control on some of these policy issues.
But you wouldn't just categorically rule out the concept of a voucher-type program?
I wouldn't rule out the concept of the federal government trying to help solve problems of failing schools, but I'm not sure that a voucher is the best way to do that.
What about gun control? Do we need different, tighter gun laws? Do we need more gun laws?
Well, I think we need to apply, do some common sense things to protect kids that that we're not doing now. I think applying the same kinds of background check rules to gun shows that we apply to gun shops is just a logical step to take so that we're consistent and we don't have a major loophole in how a criminal can get hold of a gun. And I think we ought to look at other sort of common sense steps to restrict access to, you know, multi-bullet magazines on weapons that add to the damage that people can do. There are just some common sense things that that we ought to do to protect our kids.
Ben, your question, please.
Yes, I'm calling from Bloomington, and I'm just wondering about whether we have a role in protecting small farmers. I'm wondering if maybe we should just let the market function and let agribusiness run its course if they are indeed, you know, there still could be competition with agribusiness. Do we really need to bail out the farmers? I'd just like to get his reaction on that.
I'm support market solutions to problems where we can use them, but there are clearly places that the market fails. And one of the places that I think the market can fail with respect to agriculture is not take into account the environmental costs of moving to ever larger farms. And I think small farmers have demonstrated that they can do things in an environmentally sensitive way, and that's one of the reasons why I suggested that we ought to look at farm subsidies that put an emphasis on sustainable, environmentally sound farming approaches. I think those kinds of external costs that some farming practices can create are things that folks throughout the state ought to care about, not just people in the rural areas. And I think people who live in the metropolitan area need to care about them too. I also think that it is important to have a populated rural area and not a wasteland of folks. There's a lot of productivity in the people and in the land in Minnesota, and we need to support that in an appropriate way. And as I said earlier, I think it's not an at all cost proposition, but there are some intelligent things that we can do that will enable family farmers to sustain their operations, but at the same time create other kinds of opportunities in rural areas as well.
In terms of market forces and the rest, there are a lot of people who are very anxious about what appears to be the brave new world we've moved into in terms of the global economy and the rest. Again, at the risk of oversimplifying, where would you place yourself on the scale of free trade versus fair trade, as it's often called?
Well, I think the United States' prosperity depends on open trade, on more interaction with economies and people in other parts of the world. But we need to find techniques for doing that in a way that ensures that workers in other countries, not just in the United States, are working under fair conditions, that we're not just shifting pollution from the United States to some other country. Those are, I think, important values and standards that we ought to be applying, but I don't think the way to do it is to close borders and sort of build walls. I think we need to find some other techniques to raise standards. I'm encouraged by some non-governmental things that are going on. You see college students working to raise the standards at Nike factories through market pressure on Nike. You see buyers and other people getting together to raise environmental standards in agricultural products in other countries. I think those are the kinds of things that the federal government could provide support for without raising tariff barriers to trade.
Do you think NAFTA was a good idea, North American Free Trade Agreement?
I support NAFTA.
Mm-hmm. Russell, your question?
Yes, Senator Kelly, it's very nice to have you in the race. I'm very excited about the lineup to go against Senator Graham. So I was always surprised that he got elected in the first place. As a lifelong Democrat, I feel that the last election was mostly ours to lose, and the infighting within the within our own party lost us a lot of power. I know I did phone callings and things, and I went in and people weren't even calling for Humphrey. Freeman seemed to have such a strong base that I went to my caucus meetings and Freeman was already the winner there, and that Skip Humphrey had brought all this money and had all this notoriety. Being a person that mostly listens to NPR and is mostly well informed, I was very surprised that on a grassroots level the party was moving in a completely different direction, and I don't think it ever got back on course, and may have been part of the problem that we lost the election. Now you have Cerisi to go against. I was so very excited that he was coming in with his big bucks, and also he has the same notoriety from the tobacco. But is there some way to, will you abide by the endorsement so that we don't have this contentiousness going up clear to the election? And also, how are you going to contend with the Cerisi and his money and the outside money coming in to support Rod Grams?
I have not decided yet whether I'm going to abide by an endorsement. And the reason I'm being reserved on that is that my concern is that if we endorse a candidate who, on principle, I'm pro-choice, for example, and if we were somehow to endorse a candidate who is not pro-choice, I'd want to have an option to think about whether I'd run in the primary. In terms of competing on the money front, money is very important, and I'm going to work very hard to raise the kind of money necessary to run a strong campaign. But I think we're going to try to do some other things. One of the advantages that Governor Ventura brought to his campaign last year was that people understood that he was talking about things that he himself thought were important, and I'm going to try to do that myself and try to talk about things I'm committed to. We're also going to try to build a sense of fun into the campaign, and if you check out the website at www.kelly2000.org, we're going to try to use some humor, and I think the governor, through his advertising, used that technique as well. So those are some of the things that I'm going to try to do to offset the advantages of candidates who are who have a lot of their own wealth.
Is there any other issue other than abortion that would be one of those defining philosophical issues that might give you pause and think maybe you should go on to the primary?
There might be some key environmental issues or possibly gun control issues that would make that decision for me. I haven't gone through the whole list.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the activists who will likely show up at the precinct caucus next spring and end up handling the endorsements, are they representative of the party as a whole, or are they representative of the general electorate as a whole?
The endorsement's going to be very important to me, and I've been endorsed in all the races I've run for the state legislature. There is obviously a narrowing process, but the people I know as state delegates, especially the people from my district, those folks are average working people. They might be teachers or carpenters or electricians, and so at least the folks I know in the party are representative. I know when you look at polling samples and things like that, there is a difference. The delegates at the state convention tend to be more liberal than the folks who vote in the primary, and certainly more than the general electorate. But when you look at them one by one, they seem pretty representative to me.
Mm-hmm. Russell raised the issue of money, and that always seems to come up now when we talk about candidates and campaigns and the rest. Would you like to see total public funding of federal election campaigns?
I don't know about total. I think there is something to Minnesota's approach to this, where you have to get to some threshold amount to demonstrate that you've got some support among citizens in the state or in the district before you can get access to the public money. But I do think that public financing is an important thing that we ought to be looking about in congressional races, because the campaign shouldn't be about money. It should be about the kind of person you are and the kinds of issues that you're going to work on.
Fundamental to the debate in Washington right now is the whole argument over whether to ban soft money or not is this argument that fundamentally money corrupts the system. Do you agree with that? Are we operating under a corrupt political system?
My biggest problem with the money issue is not the corruption, it's the time commitment. In a state Senate campaign, I can spend most of my time going out and talking to voters, usually at their doors, finding out what's on their minds and having a one-to-one interaction. The problem of raising money in a U.S. Senate campaign means that I keep being told you have to spend most of your time on the phone asking for money. That means you don't have the time available to spend listening to people's day-to-day concerns.
Jim, your question, please.
Yes, good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
I have a question about export of cryptography. Currently, U.S. law makes it very difficult to export modern cryptography. And as a consequence, high technology businesses are starting to suffer in international competition. How do you feel about changing those laws?
I think the notion that the United States has a monopoly on strong cryptography and therefore that we can prevent cryptography products from getting into the hands of criminals or terrorists, it just ignores the fact that there are very strong technology centers outside the country that can produce some of these products. Israel has a terrific group of programmers, and India has a strong educational system for programmers. And so I think we've just been hurting ourselves by this notion that that by adopting policies to prevent export of strong encryption products, that we're keeping encryption out of the hands of the bad guys.
Back to the phones. Lene, your question for Senator Kelly.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. There is information out currently that illustrates the fact that the nation's middle class is shrinking as the upper class, as well as the lower class, continue to grow. And economists predict that this phenomenon will have serious adverse reactions on society in multiple ways. I would like to know what you know about this matter and also what role you can see the government taking to preserve the middle class and the balance of power within the nation on a national level.
I am concerned that we preserve a strong middle class because if you look across the globe, countries with a strong middle class are also the ones with the strongest democracies, and I think that's an important commitment in this country. I think the kinds of policies that we need to pursue in the new economy to preserve a strong middle class are the ones that build on improving people's skills, creating new opportunities and incentives for people to add to their skills and move to higher paying jobs. That might mean adopting policies to make pensions more portable so that people have a sense of security that if they take the risk on moving to a higher paying job, that they aren't leaving behind their retirement pay, things like that. We've got to be much more specific about raising skills, and there are some things that we're doing in Minnesota that we ought to be doing at the federal level. The Job Skills Partnership Act, which gets the state funds and which we added to substantially this year, provides incentives for partnerships between employers and educational institutions so that the education institutions create training programs tailored to the needs of the business. One of the really successful examples of that is the partnership between Normandale Community College and some firms that make computer chips and disk drives. They need technicians who can make these rooms super clean, that keep the dust out of the rooms where these things are manufactured. And they couldn't find a labor supply for those kinds of technicians. The state helped build a bridge between the employers and Normandale, and the people who go through that two-year training program in vacuum technology, make middle-class salaries after 2 years of post-secondary training. And I think those are the kinds of things we ought to be doing more of and that the federal government ought to support.
How important is it to raise the minimum wage?
I think raising the minimum wage is part of the tool, but you know a lot of McDonald's are employing people at above the minimum wage. I think the thing we ought to be really focusing on is raising the information value of people's jobs. If we're going to be in an information society, then having more information built into your product, into the job you do, the kinds of skills you have means you're going to produce more value. And I think that's the long-term success for the United States is to add more value to our people by providing them with more information, more skills, more knowledge. That's the way we'll win in this race against folks around the world. And one of the things about the new economy is we need to do that, and I think the caller was pointing at this question. We may have had the attitude in the past that if we did well for the top third of students and the top third of workers, we'd be doing okay. But to do well in this new economy, we have to make sure that all our workers, all our students are working up to their potential and have all the opportunities to add to their skill set, because I think this is an obstacle course race where it's the first team to the finish line, not the first individual to the finish line, that is going to win.
Do you think we should modify the new welfare law in this country as a result coming out of that thinking, so that people would be able to spend more time in training and education rather than being required to get a job?
Well, there's an important first step, and that is that people develop the so-called soft skills of showing up on time at work and being responsible. And so it may not be the right first step that people coming off welfare should get more and more training. It may be the right first step that they should have a job, develop those skills, and then make sure that we have the follow-on job skills training to raise their skill level and help them move up to a better paying job.
Healthcare, is it time for the federal government to get on with providing universal health care insurance?
Well, as I said yesterday when I announced my candidacy, I'm wary of the notion of universal, meaning a new federal bureaucracy. One of the problems we've got is that people are uncomfortable even with the corporate bureaucracies that we've got who are administering health care. And we need to find a way that to deliver health care services and provide affordable insurance for people that doesn't involve more centralization of decision making. And one of my concerns about a universal or federally run health plan for everybody is that we would be centralizing too much decision making in Washington.
In terms of trying to balance the federal budget or keep it in balance, would you, there's a thought in Washington that we should set aside all the Social Security surplus funds to protect Social Security, even if that means some fairly tight budget restraints on the rest of the budget. Do you support that approach?
I think trying to preserve the integrity of the Social Security Trust Fund and possibly add to it is something we ought to look at. It's an important thing to make sure that we have got Social Security fully funded so that our kids aren't facing the burden of paying for the big baby boom generation retirement costs. In terms of the other parts of the budget, If we are talking about cutting research funding in order to avoid borrowing $10 billion, I think that's a bad trade-off. If we need to borrow $10 billion this year in order to preserve the kind of funding for education and research and development that's important to this country's leadership position, we ought to do that. And then next year, identify where the growth in the economy is producing a surplus and then reinvest that. I think trying to force ourselves into some of these budget constraints, if it means making bad decisions now, is short-sighted.
We're unfortunately just about out of time here, but I did want to ask you, Senator Kelly, before we wrap up, it seems like, in general, people are pretty much turned off to politics, just not much interested. Why do you suppose that is? How do you get them interested again in the system, if they ever were?
If I had the surely right answer to that, I might move into a different line of work than actually running in this. But there are a couple things that I think are important. One is we have done some things in policy making at the national level, at the state level, that takes power away from the average citizen to influence outcomes. And it's important that we re-engage citizens, that we give them new ways of participating, and that we give them real power to make decisions at the local level in their communities. Politicians at all levels have to do that. I think that's one part of the solution.
Okay. Thanks for coming in today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.